Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
Week on The Wheelhouse. Early voting in Connecticut. And a little later, regulating big tech and judicial diversity. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. For a long time, Connecticut has been one of just four states without early voting. Last November, though, residents voted overwhelmingly in favor of bringing it to the state. And just last week, the House approved legislation requiring 14 days of early voting. But Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas says early voting won't actually start this year. So we phoned a friend to understand why that won't happen. And a good friend of mine is on the phone right now. That's Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CT News Junkie. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
And Christine, if anybody's listening to us, they could actually call us over the phone if they want to talk to us, ask us maybe a couple of questions, maybe another question more than I'll ask you. 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677, the number to call us this morning. So the big question, Christine, why will there be a delay in implementing early voting in Connecticut?
So the delay in early voting in Connecticut is because Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas said that the vote obviously happened after May 1st, and that comes too late for the state vendor to make the necessary updates to the voting infrastructure, which would include the centralized voter registration system. So because we've already passed that deadline, she was urging the legislature to get their act in gear and try to pass it in March for this year, which would have been, you know, municipal elections. Instead, we're going to have it for the presidential year in 2024 if the Senate passes it, which I imagine that they will.
Voting infrastructure, as you just mentioned, is kind of hung in the background. It's really formed the backdrop for this kind of the delay and really how people think about the future of voting in Connecticut, because it sounds like there will have to be updates to the infrastructure in order to facilitate this. So do we know what kind of updates it's going to take to get this done?
Well, I mean, updates to the centralized voter registration system, which are, you know, for the most part, always happening. But also, it's going to require municipalities to hire more election officials for a longer period of time than just on election day. So trying to get all the people in place and all of the infrastructure in place to make this happen is quite the undertaking, and is going to take, you know, more than a year in order to do this.
And I want to talk to you about municipalities and maybe the crunch that some of these registrars of voters, the local people that run elections, are feeling at this time. But I got to know, how are folks, including lawmakers, feeling about the delay? Were they hoping to test during the municipal elections this year?
Well, I think that, you know, they were being pushed to do that, but they, you know, didn't necessarily want to. And there wasn't really much political will behind that. I mean, it's odd because, you know, the voters of Connecticut said they went to the ballot last November and they said, yes, we want early voting. It, you know, the question didn't ask how long they want early voting for, but they said, yes, we want early voting. So in order to implement the will of the voters, the legislature had to move forward. But apparently they're not as concerned that if they don't do this in a timely manner, that voters will revolt against them.
Overwhelming support, as you said, 60-40 was the breakdown in the vote. Why didn't Connecticut have early voting for so long, Christine?
So we actually tried. So we tried back in, I want to say it was 2014. We tried to get it on the ballot and it failed. And it failed, they think, because of the way that the question was worded on the ballot, but it was soundly defeated. So it took a really long time then for two consecutive legislatures to pass legislation that would allow for this question to go back out to voters. And I think that it's just, you know, Connecticut is very, you know, we're just set in our ways. We're the cranky Yankees and we don't like change. Change is hard, right? So it was just the way that it had always been done. And I think that people are nervous about change.
Land of steady habits. Cranky Yankees is a new one, though, that I haven't necessarily heard that I now love and will be stealing from Christine Stewart. Steal from us. Ask us a few questions if you want to. Give us a call right now, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Been a couple proposals before lawmakers this session on early voting, but last Thursday, lawmakers settled on a final bill, something like 107 votes in favor of this. I apologize. What does it include, this package that they finally settled on? The House.
The House, the bill will include 14 days of early voting prior to a November election and 4 days ahead of special elections and presidential primaries. So, you know, this will give voters a little bit more time to get to the polls. I mean, there are many people who have jobs that, you know, go from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. when the polls are open, or there are people who go to their jobs and expect to be able to get to the polls that day, and then they're called in for like a mandatory, you know, overtime shift and have been unable to vote. And since we really haven't had no excuse absentee balloting, you know, before the pandemic, it made it very hard for a lot of working people to cast their ballots.
This session, and predominantly this, excuse me, especially this vote that we're talking about in particular on Thursday in the House, there were a lot of amendments thrown out there, and we saw some of the opposition form to early voting, or at least, as they say, this proposal on early voting. So what was that session like last Thursday as they're kind of bandying about early voting, the days and all that?
So Republicans introduced a few amendments, but their main amendment was like, hey, yeah, the voters said we want early voting, so we're going to try to implement the will of the voters, but we think that 14 days is too long. I mean, the Secretary of State had recommended 10 days, but we think that 14 days is too long. How about we do 3 days and we revisit the issue next year, and if 3 days ends up not being enough, then, you know, then maybe we can add more days to that. But they felt that we were starting maybe at the higher end of the spectrum with the amount of days that were allocated. But, you know, the argument to 14 days is that many of these other 46 states have voting periods that are much longer than 14 days. And that 14 days seems to be a nice average number to use. I mean, other states, you know, Michigan has 40 days before the election. Montana has 30 days before the election. Nebraska has 30 days before the election. So Connecticut really is an outlier in regards to not having any early voting. So I think that anything is a step in the right direction, but I think the opposition was much like, let's start slow.
Joining us on The Wheelhouse right now is Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief, chief boss woman of the CT News Junkie. And I've got a clip for you, Christine. House Minority Leader Vincent Candelora, he's a Republican out of North Brantford. He's a no vote on the proposal that made it through this chamber. He says it was a rejection of the process and not a rejection of early voting. But he's taken issue with costs associated with doing 14 days of early voting. Christine just mentioned that, maybe talking about three at some point. He's talked about ballot security, even took a shot at Democrats with some comment about how the hours of operation 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on in-person early voting days only work for people who vote Democrat.
My only solace is that next year we do have an opportunity to come back and maybe make fixes to these bills after we begin to hear from our registrars and from our communities about how this bill is going to work.
React to that, Christine. What do you think?
You know, I think that they have a plan set forth. I think that there is a lot of, I hate to say that it's party politics, but I think that there's skepticism about the security of the ballot, just like in a national sense, because of everything that happened in 2020. But I think that Connecticut, our voting system is so decentralized. Every town, every registrar of voters, because they are elected officials within their towns, are the ones who are in charge of those paper ballots. And so these early votes will be cast, but they won't be counted until the polls close on election day. And I think that all of the local registrars take ballot security very, very seriously. I think that there has to be a certain amount of trust in, so you don't trust state government. Well, state government really isn't all that involved in the overall voting process and the counting, and everything is decentralized. So trust in that local elected official.
And we should say that one of the purveyors of this discussion around ballot security that was talking about 14 days of early voting or going away from that and maybe going with two or three or something like that was a Republican named Dominic Rapini, who ran against Stephanie Thomas in the election in November and was a part of a group that challenged elections locally in 2020, kind of following along with what was happening nationally with Donald Trump. Talking a lot about challenges right now. So I want to ask you, you're talking about the challenges that people face in this decentralized form of voting. What are the biggest challenges to implementing early voting in the state? What do you think? Is it that decentralized thing? Is there other things?
Well, I think that the challenge is finding the finances to make sure that municipalities can pull this off. The state didn't seem to want to allocate any money to the municipalities in order to pull this off, which is also one of the reasons that it's on the back burner for another year. But it's estimated cost cities and towns around $4.4 million. And as much as $9.2 million when the final state costs are factored in. So, you know, let's say at the top end, it's going to cost $10 million in order to implement this. But this is also one of those constitutional rights, the right to vote. So can you really put a price on it?
Yeah, you talked about that local price and then the state price. Originally, the state's Office of Fiscal Analysis saw this costing around like $2 million a fiscal year. A newer fiscal note pledges to get the cost down by about $500,000, probably in the way that they ran the hours of operation, it sounds like, in terms of offering early voting. But that's an important number to pay attention to, the fact that there is going to be an all-in kind of cost for cities and towns that Christine just mentioned, something like $4.4 million. I just want to note that the Connecticut Public, thanks to Matt Dwyer, reached out to the Registrars of Voters Association of Connecticut because of this concern that local municipalities would take a financial hit under the new early voting proposal. Registrars of Voters Association of Connecticut saying that the money for early voting is covered in the new proposed two-year state budget and by other sources. And Association President Chris Prue says he's working with the Secretary of the State to ensure costs are not dumped on the towns. Anything you want to say to kind of button up this discussion on what local municipalities are going to have to do? We also got to talk about training, I would imagine, too, Christine.
Oh, yeah, training. I mean, you know, so the requirement under this bill is to make sure that there's at least one polling place open in every town in those 14 days leading up to the election. So you're talking about, you know, staffing. There has to be a moderator there. You have to have, you know, the concern from some of the Republicans were like, you know, we have trouble staffing the polls for one day a year. How are we going to staff the polls for 14 days. And so it's training these officials and making sure that they are available for those days. And, you know, every town is going to be different. Every town is going to need a different amount of people to be trained on this. So I think that that's probably their biggest concern.
And as you mentioned early on in this program, really, this is the will of the people. This is what people in Connecticut wanted. So can you kind of help me as we kind of finish out this conversation here with how early voting is going to benefit people in Connecticut and who exactly benefits from this in your estimation?
Well, I think, you know, everybody benefits. Everybody benefits regardless of what party you belong to. They benefit because they have a longer time to get to the polls. They can still go on election day if they want to go on election day. But there is not anything necessarily totally special about election day anymore. So, you know, the people who have to go to work, on a regular basis and need to find time to do this. And, you know, I think the Republican argument that, people would have found time if they thought it was important and they would go to the polls. I don't think our voter turnout numbers necessarily think that. And I think that turnout is always low and that turnout will be much higher as a result of this.
People got to work. Christine Stewart always working through two jobs, being a mom. Happy Mother's Day, Christine. Nice to talk to you here.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you for coming on. We'll talk to you a bit soon. I can't wait to have you back on the Wheelhouse soon. The next segment, we're going to talk about social media restrictions and trying to make sure that there is some safety online with Lisa Hagan. Give us a call if you want to talk. 888-720-9677. You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We move now from early voting to big tech. Connecticut Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, they got two competing bills before Congress aimed at protecting children online. And really, to talk us through how they differ and what they'd mean for children and parents, we're joined by our very own federal policy reporter for both us, Connecticut Public, and CT Mirror. It's also my friend. I got all my friends on this hour. It feels like I'm listening in my head to My Friends by Red Hot Chili Peppers. Lisa Hagan joins us on the line right now. How are you today, Lisa?
Hey, it's good. I'm happy to make my Wheelhouse debut.
This is the Wheelhouse debut. How about that? You talked to us a bunch right before we actually went live with the Wheelhouse as we were doing this as part of Where We Live when we were helping out Catherine Chen for a little while. How are you doing today, Lisa?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good. I'd be better if I were seeing you in person like I was last week. Hey, I want to tell folks that they could join the conversation if they'd like to and ask us a couple of questions, whatever you need right now at this hour, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Lisa, why are federal lawmakers so focused on social media platforms right now? I guess why not? But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, basically, Congress hasn't really done anything on this issue at the federal level, especially to protect children online, since the late 1990s. And so for the past few years, I mean, I think they've been trying to do this for a while, but over the past few years, lawmakers have been more aggressive about this, trying to make more serious efforts to do something. And that came out of some whistleblower reports on Facebook. And so now we're seeing major efforts with a whole litany of bills trying to hold tech companies accountable. And so the movement we're kind of seeing now in Congress and at the federal level is really on trying to protect children, especially when they have these online experiences, and especially as they're trying to address this growing mental health crisis for children and teens.
In the reporting that you could see online at ctmirror.org and ctpublic.org from Lisa Hagan, she talks about a watershed moment in the battle for online safety. Testimony on Capitol Hill from Frances Haugen. She was a Facebook whistleblower. She said she gave federal lawmakers documents about showing how Facebook repeatedly misled the public about what its own research reveals about the safety of children. And before I go to Lisa, I'm going to play a clip for Lisa.
Facebook understands that if they want to continue to grow, they have to find new users. They have to make sure that the next generation is just as engaged with Instagram as the current one. And the way they'll do that is by making sure that children establish habits before they have good self-regulation.
No real regulation online since the 90s, as you mentioned, Lisa, but that was a big moment in 2021 with Frances Haugen. How has that really got us to where we are today here in 2023 with an attempt to try to get some kind of online safety going?
Yes, we really saw this this moment grow when Senators Richard Blumenthal, who's from Connecticut, and then also Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, put out last year the Kids Online Safety Act. And so that was really the one focused on children specifically, making sure that they're, you know, reducing harm, something that Frances Haugen spoke about and something that we've, you know, we've heard in testimony since from children and parent advocates, is that they're being exposed to content that maybe increases, you know, disordered eating, suicide, just a whole litany of things. And so Blumenthal put out this bill, got really close to passing last year, and so he's reintroduced it this year. And then, as you said, Connecticut kind of taking the lead on these issues. Senator Chris Murphy, also of Connecticut, has also introduced his own bill on this matter. And so we're really starting to see this gain a bit of momentum in Congress, and now we just have to see if they can get enough support to pass it through divided government.
You just mentioned Senator Chris Murphy. Can we talk about his proposal first, which is Protecting Kids on Social Media, that act? Go ahead.
Yeah, so that one specifically, it's pretty different from the Blumenthal one. It basically has an age requirement and parental consent, and so minors between 13 and 17 would need consent from a parent or legal guardian to sign up for any of social media. And then basically it would also ban anyone under 13 from using any kind of social media platform. And so something that, you know, the Murphy and the other senators have noted is that a lot of these apps already have bans on kids under 13 from using this. And so they argue that it shouldn't really be all that different, but really also that parental consent component of it. And I'd say where the two bills overlap between the two Connecticut senators is that they want to basically limit how algorithms show content to those under 18 years old. And so that's the overlap we see, but it's really this age limit that is a huge component. And I'll note that for Senator Murphy and the other senators who introduced this, they're all parents of really young kids who would actually be affected by this bill. And so it's a really personal one for them.
And you think that's driving this, especially for Chris Murphy?
Yeah, I think so. I think his oldest is a young teen, so would actually, you know, again, be impacted by this. And so not to say that Senator Blumenthal, he also has, you know, adult children. A lot of senators have children in Congress, whether that be young ones or older ones. And so I think it's personal for everyone, but especially for Senator Murphy and his group.
The Kids Online Safety Act, that's by Blumenthal. Can you tell me what that does?
Yeah, so again, that's a bit different. It doesn't have age requirements in it. Blumenthal is pretty vehemently opposed to that. It does have a parental consent component, but for those under 13, and he says that that's pretty much in alignment with current federal law. And so his, again, focuses more on basically what the content that children are seeing. And so again, it's that algorithms making sure that kids aren't getting recommended through these little, you know, kind of what they call addictive methods in social media. And then also basically putting a legal duty of care on social media companies and tech companies to protect children and reduce harm from the content they're seeing. And so Blumenthal has told me this is basically a way of getting both parents and kids involved in their experience, and not just, you know, putting it on parents, but also empowering children and trying to get them to also, you know, really care for and, you know, regulate their own online experience.
I have to underscore this again, because these two are usually aligned on key policy issues. Chris Murphy, and as you'll often see them together in Connecticut speaking at the same events, Chris will refer to his friend Richard Blumenthal, Dick. He'll introduce him a lot of times, but here they are not aligned here. So, and it sounds like it's the age limits, as you mentioned earlier, that are keeping these two apart on this. Why doesn't Richard Blumenthal think age limits are the solution?
Yeah, I'll start first to say that, yes, while they differ pretty, you know, pretty much on the age limit and age requirement and a bit on the parental consent, they are largely aligned otherwise. And so something I'll note is that when Richard Blumenthal reintroduced this bill last week, Chris Murphy is a co-sponsor on it. And a lot of the people who are on that Chris Murphy bill who are co-sponsors and sponsors also support the Blumenthal bill. And so it's really just a sticking point on this age requirement. And so Blumenthal has told me that it is a really difficult thing to enforce. I think for a lot of people like Blumenthal and supporters of his bill believe that there are also still positive experiences for children online. And so they don't want to limit that potentially. And again, it's something that he told me is that he wants to make sure that it doesn't all fall on parents. He thinks that it doesn't hold the tech companies accountable and it just puts the burden on parents, and that he also wants kids involved. But again, I'll just underscore that while they have some differing approaches on this, they are aligned in getting something done on this. And that is really focused on the algorithms that target children and get kids to stay on the app for longer periods of time.
Could it be more of like who you're in the company with when you're talking about age restrictions? I'll just note some of your reporting here. Josh Hawley, United States Senator from Missouri, we know him from some January 6th content outside of the building, him both running out of the building on January 6th and then being looked like he was trying to support the efforts by insurrectionists. And then it's Arizona and Utah that are the states, the states that are supportive of age restrictions. Do you think that has anything to do with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the states, I think they're looking to the federal government and saying, hey, you haven't done anything on this in a really long time, and we're not sure if you can actually do anything. And so it's states taking this into their own hands. And so, yeah, we've seen a few states doing this. California doesn't have an age requirement, but they have also done this major online tech-related bill. And so I think the federal government is trying to take this into their own hands and say, you know, we should be doing something about this. Again, this is something that the laws on the book are pretty old at this point. And God, tech has exploded so much since then. Social media didn't really exist at the time, or very little. And so I think it's Congress trying to basically be in the center of this now and taking this on. And so and kind of matching where states are on this.
And you talked about the Senate and really the federal government trying to meet states where they are on this. And I brought up Josh Hawley there, but he's the Republican senator from Missouri. But it seems like Blumenthal and Murphy both believe that this is sort of an apolitical conversation. Seems that the proposals kind of have bipartisan support, right?
Yes. And that's why there is so much movement on bills like this. And yes, so someone like Josh Hawley and someone like, frankly, Senator Marsha Blackburn, who's the co-sponsor with Senator Blumenthal, I mean, they're not shy of saying that they are very different on most issues in terms of where they stand on things. And so they all believe that this could be fairly apolitical, that Congress should be taking the lead on something like this. And so the fact that, and again, even though you're seeing different proposals, and different ways of attacking this issue, it just shows that Congress does want to do something on it and that there is bipartisan support. And so at least when you look in terms of the Blumenthal bill, that's seeming to get the most support and the most bipartisan support at this point.
888-720-9677, the line to call if you want to talk about regulating big tech. It sounds so scary when you say it like that, big tech. You've hinted at this a couple of times in the conversation, and I didn't follow up on it, but now's the time. The last major piece of legislation protecting children under age 13 was passed in 1998, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Why has there been such limited action until now, do you think?
I think it's really hard to get anything done in Congress at this point. It's something that I think came up a lot, at least with the Frances Haugen testimony, and then also when Mark Zuckerberg came before Congress. I think it showed that members of Congress, and particularly older ones who may be more unfamiliar with this, just have more limited knowledge on this issue. And so I think now that we're constantly talking about this, we're seeing bills making their way through Congress, continued support, growing support for it. I think members of Congress are getting a little bit more education on this, and they have a better handling of this. And so, yeah, I think, and again, I just can't underscore enough that it's just really hard to get things through Congress. And even when things seem fairly apolitical and have a lot of support, there's always going to be divisions. Things just happen really slowly, even when there is support. Again, we saw some movement last year. And so, and something I will note we can get into too is just, you know, there is outside criticism for a lot of these efforts. And so that also complicates this narrative a little bit too.
And just when you thought that the Senate logjam that's been happening to a lot of lawmakers and federal government was solved, we're not even talking yet about the one in the House now. And you kind of alluded to that in your reporting. That, do you think that could kind of delay us here?
Yeah, it's hard because it seems like whatever gets moved out of Congress is going to come most likely from the Senate first, just because it's so narrowly divided. Democrats are taking, there's bipartisan efforts, but Democrats are really taking the lead. And so a little bit more. And so when you have Senate being controlled by Democrats, there seems to be a real desire to do something on it. And so I'm not saying that the House won't act on it or there won't be some support on it. But with things, you know, the power and the majority flipping over the past year to Republicans in the House, it just seems like action's going to come from the Senate. And so we're just going to have to see if the House and enough Republicans are willing to get on board on this.
And we're talking about opposition inside of the Capitol Hill. But what about opposition outside of Congress? What do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, there's been a pretty decent amount of outside criticism to both bills. And, you know, I've been following the Blumenthal one's been out there longer. And so the criticism has just been louder and longer on that. I'll just quickly touch on the Murphy one. I think we talked about this. But yeah, the fear of and just the skepticism of being able to enforce an age requirement. And so I think that's the biggest one. Again, powering parents more so over kids. So I think that's the more of the louder criticism for the Murphy bill. But when it comes to the Kids Online Safety Act, which is led by Senator Blumenthal, that one has had a decent amount of opposition from civil liberties groups, some you know, even just tech advocates in that space, LGBTQ groups. And so it's concerns over content moderation, empowering state attorneys general, regulating what minors can see. And I think what kind of dovetails with that is that what really is appropriate for children. I think there's a debate over what is appropriate content, and a lot of that gets politicized. And so and just censorship. So that's really where we're hearing the loudest criticism. And I'll note that Senator Blumenthal and Senator Blackburn have made multiple revisions to their bill to address this. And so sometimes it's alleviated some concerns. Others say there's no amount of drafts that can change how they feel on this.
What's one takeaway you could give us that they're making these amendments to try to appease some of these groups, or at least try to address some of these very real concerns?
Yeah, they're putting explicitly in the bill what they can protect, and so they want to be able to not have this apply to schools, or they don't want to have this apply to LGBTQ like youth service centers, making sure that the things that they're worried that could get bogged down or over-censored, they're basically explicitly protecting that. And then also explicitly listing what mental health disorders should be covered under this bill. And so not just generally saying all of them, but saying the specific ones. And so that is the most, that's the latest basically revision to this bill.
These two proposed measures, what do they tell us about the challenges of regulating big tech?
I mean, they're up against formidable opponents. You know, we've seen tech companies lobbying against a lot of these bills, not just these two, but a whole host of them that have been introduced in Congress, and a lot of them that Senator Blumenthal is a part of. And at the same time, you know, we've seen tech companies try to proactively address some of these issues. And so a lot of them from the jump just don't allow children under 13 to join it. And so that's why I think, you know, for Murphy's bill, he's basically saying, hey, they already do this for a lot of apps. Let's just make it, you know, across the board regulation. And with TikTok specifically, they have some measures they have in, like setting daily screen times, having things be set to a default for minors. So making their profiles private, not allowing them to direct message. Again, by default, limiting them to a certain amount of screen time a day. And so they're trying to address this so that they don't have to have Congress come in and start regulating things for them. But at the same time, it just doesn't seem like companies are really going to be on board with a lot of these measures.
There's regulating big tech and the people, all those lobbyists that go up to Capitol Hill and all the money that's around big tech. And then there's the actual technology itself. Maybe Lisa Hagan can help me one of these days figure out how I can get Theo Vaughn off my Instagram. I've been trying to do that for a long time, but it keeps popping up.
I got the policy side, not the technical side.
Someone who doesn't need any regulation, Lisa Hagan. Thank you so much for coming on The Wheelhouse. Your first time. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Frankie.
We're chatting about judicial diversity next. You can join the conversation, 888-720-9677. You're listening to The Wheelhouse.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. Before we wrap today's show, we wanted to tell you about one more big political story. And that story is all about Connecticut's judges. Before we get into the latest, here's a little judge 101 for you in Connecticut. The Judicial Selection Commission recommends qualified candidates to the governor. The governor then chooses candidates for their approved lists and refers them to the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee for confirmation. Both chambers must approve the nominees before they become a judge, both the House and Senate. You might be thinking, why is Frankie telling me about all this right now, especially? Well, Governor Ned Lamont recently announced a slate of judicial nominees. Some people aren't exactly happy about his choices. One reason, diversity. I don't necessarily mean diversity in terms of race or gender. No, I'm talking about professional diversity. For more on what I mean by that, we're joined by a guest here on Zoom, Michael Marciano, the bureau chief of the Connecticut Law Tribune, somebody I've leaned on in the last few years as a reporter at Connecticut Public to help me with the law. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, Frankie. Congratulations on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on here today. I appreciate it. And if you want to talk to Michael and I, give us a call, 888-720-9677. Michael, this is a big question. What do we mean when we say professional diversification of the bench?
So we're talking about judges who have either had experience in public defense or who have done some public work aside from working in the corporate arena or working in prosecutions. We want I'm not saying I want, but I think the people who are calling for more diversity want to see more judges who have been on the defense side in for people as opposed to corporations and large entities.
And that's right. You're talking about corporations, large entities, as opposed to maybe seeing some of these legal aid attorneys or public defense attorneys. I just want to now ask you, how's the judicial branch structured and where's this lack of diversity most pronounced?
I think it's the higher up you go. So like if you start at a local judge level, you're going to get a lot of diversity. And then if you move up to higher courts, it will be less and less. And I think that's because you need people with more experience at the higher level. So it's not, I don't think it's like a nefarious thing that's happening. I think it's just nature of the business, you know?
Yeah. And it sounds like, for example, there was a certain group that did this coverage of what they see as the problem with professional diversification of the bench. It's the People's Parity Project. And they're saying that, as Michael just pointed out, the higher up you go, there's a bigger divide on the appellate court, for example. Do you have the numbers there, or can you just kind of give us an example of why the appellate court and the Supreme Court are not showing any kind of this pro-diversity?
Yeah, I think at the appellate level, it was particularly stark in terms of they didn't have any public interest attorneys at that level. I don't really know why that is, to tell you the truth. It's just, that's the way it's shaken out over the past few years.
People's Parity Project saying the appellate and Supreme Court's representation, even worse, obviously, 75% of judges having prosecutorial or corporate experience. Appellate courts no longer have legal aid or public defender background, according to the People's Parity Project. Why do you think there's this overrepresentation of former prosecutors and corporate attorneys serving as Connecticut judges?
There may just be more of them, and I think that they have maybe have more interaction with the government in general, and they may have higher profile jobs in which they receive more consideration. It's a combination of factors, I'm sure.
So we're talking about the professional diversification of the bench, and really, I guess I want to kind of get to the heart of the matter here. Why is it important to have attorneys with backgrounds in legal aid, public defense, and civil rights, for example? What's the thought behind having that kind of support at the bench?
Yeah, I think the main thing that the people like the groups like People's Parity want is to recognize that a judge's life experience is important too. You know, you want to know that they understand you just like anybody else you go to, for professional services, that they come from something similar that you do, that, they'll be able to give you a fair shake.
Can you tell me about the work the People's Parity Project at UConn Law does and why it's relevant in this case?
You know, I think they've been very active over the past couple of months, 2-3 months, just lobbying the governor's office about this issue and trying to get time. I think they did speak with the governor's general counsel, and they actually called us and they did some op-eds. So I think they've just lobbying, they've done a pretty good job. And I don't know if it's, the timing may not be great because the latest group of 20 has been approved and sent through and they're done, and it's not a bad group as far as diversity goes either, to tell you the truth. So but maybe the next round they'll have a little bit more influence on the process.
I want to talk about those 20 judicial nominations in a second, but just let's button up this part. What do you think the impact of having a more balanced bench would be on, I guess, Connecticut at large and our state residents?
Hopefully not much different than it is. I think you kind of hope that the system is fair and that people are fair and that they treat each other with the right, well, I hate to say fairness again, but fairness. And, you know, that's what you're looking for. And I think there may be prosecutors who treat defendants more fairly as judges because they, you know, they have a bigger heart when they're on the bench, or they are able to see through arguments a little bit better because they're on the bench and have a prosecutorial background. So that, you know, I'm not necessarily convinced that, you know, you can pigeonhole everybody just on their past experience.
And the People's Parity Project, a reason why we're talking about this is their reporting in this report that they released in the spring of 2022, saying that about 60% of the judges in Connecticut were found to have either corporate or prosecutorial experiences. And the concern there on the prosecutorial side is that they may not have as much empathy with some of the defendants. And I guess in terms of when we're talking about sentencing and, I guess, time served. And then there's always the concern on the corporate side that they may not hold corporate entities accountable if they've worked for them in the past. That's just the kind of thoughts behind why there may be a need for more balance. We talked about Governor Lamont and these new nominations that they have in the state of Connecticut. Has the governor been open to these concerns about the makeup of the judiciary and, I guess, the People's Parity Project? Talk to the general counselor. What do you think the administration's done to address these kind of concerns?
I think there's been a good focus on diversity, both professional and, you know, cultural, and that it's sort of been off the lead of the Biden administration, what they've done with nominations across the country. I think we sort of are following that lead and nominating good, diverse judges who should show, you know, good promise. I think they're all going through the judge school right now, so we'll know in the coming weeks and months how they do as judges.
Governor Ned Lamont making 20 judicial nominations to fill vacancies on the state Superior Court bench. Can you tell me about the professional diversity of those nominees?
There are some prosecutors, there are some corporate lawyers, there are some a few public defenders. I think Karen DiMiola from UConn Law is she's sort of in public interest law and diversity and inclusion. So it's nice to see people who come from different backgrounds who are being chosen to serve as judges.
Concerns over some of the nominees, including Sandra Slack Glover for the Connecticut Supreme Court. Can you tell me about her and what people are concerned about when we talk about Sandra Slack Glover?
Yeah, I think the main thing people are bringing up is that she was on this letter in support of Amy Coney Barrett during that nomination round at the U.S. Supreme Court. And I've talked to people on the Judiciary Committee, and they seem to think that that will result in some tough questioning for her when they do come to her nomination.
Do you think that she'll be confirmed? And then I want to ask you, kind of as you consider that, anything we should look out for in the coming weeks and months when it comes to judicial diversity or even confirmations in the state?
You know, I don't know if she'll be confirmed, but my swing toward yes, that she will be confirmed. And then I also think we should have maybe toward the later part of the year, maybe we'll have some more actual nominations for Superior Court judges. But I think, you know, the discussion is what's good, getting people to talk about it and say, you know, what they want to see on the courts.
Michael Marciano, Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Law Tribune, thank you for coming on The Wheelhouse this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Nice to talk to you. Today's show produced by Meg Dalton. What a great show she put together today, huh? Technical producer is Kat Pastor. Super huge thanks to a good friend that stopped by the studio today, and Katie Pellico to help us out, and Katie Tolarski, of course, for helping us in studio. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. Thank you for listening.